All right, hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Halsey Hires Turn to Drive, and it's about someone who is a poet, activist, anarchist, student, who works in literature for harm reduction, and who has a manuscript coming out, and happens to also have a number of poems where driving comes up, which speaks to my heart. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about Halsey Hier. Halsey Hier, hello!
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And I think the first big question is, since this is a two-party state, do you consent to this phone call being recorded?
I absolutely consent to this phone call being recorded.
All right, so we are no longer committing wire fraud. Good for us.
Amazing!
Yes. Yeah, so where do we begin? So you are involved in a number, I think, of very interesting projects, I guess. That's where we start, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That works for me.
Yeah, so I guess I didn't want to talk about the Goat Farm Poetry Review. I mean, that's on the list, right?
Yeah, so Goat Farm Poetry Society actually started by mistake, which is always really fun. So basically, there's this one coffee shop in Bloomfield called Crazy Mocha. I mean, it's a Pittsburgh chain. A lot of people are familiar with it. And basically, I started kind of like palling around there maybe 3 years ago because I like had like met someone who was a regular there. And we all just kind of, like everyone in the Bloomfield community or like a lot of people who came through there just started reading and writing poetry and just like literature and just talking about it regularly. And somebody came up to me and was like, hey, so when are we going to do the workshop? And I was like, well, what are you talking about? And and then it was just kind of unfolded from there. You know, we started, you know, picking different writers to kind of focus and look at content and craft and how it's just moving us as people who move through the world. And then it evolved into, you know, wanting to do workshops, you know, giving feedback on everyone's poems. And then it just kept evolving. You know, we've raised money for, you know, organizations that do harm reduction work in Pittsburgh, like Prevention Point Pittsburgh. We've raised money for, we've raised money for, you know, also Literacy Pittsburgh. We've also worked with, pardon me,
okay.
We're also working with Sisters TGH right now to raise money for them. We initially wanted to, you know, raise money for them because their drop-in space caught on fire recently.
Yeah.
And now, you know, they're doing just so much work for trans people during the pandemic. You know, it really only makes sense to continue to support them as, you know, like trans people of color are the most marginalized population within all of our communities. And then we like put out zines. We're working on zine number 3 right now. And it's titled Kaleidoscope. It just features, you know, all sorts of different Pittsburgh writers, so it's just really exciting.
That does sound exciting. And you know, what I think is interesting about it and what you're saying is that it seems like community works on two levels through Goat Farm. I mean, one being, of course, and I think that's super important, you know, the idea of having a literary community and having contemporaries and having contemporary minds to work with, which I guess out there somewhere, and maybe some people still believe in this idea of poet, writer, as heroic loner genius.
Yeah.
Which, it ain't how it works, right?
For some people, I think that's 100% how poetry works, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's really challenging for some people to kind of break away from the typical and standard narrative.
Mm.
You know, because that, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but it's like, that goes all the way back to, like, Platonic and beyond, like, from the Greek times.
Oh, God, yes.
Like, poesis and everything like that.
Those assholes, yeah.
And I mean, I think that, personally, I think it's important to understand where things come from. And so it's like, while I might hold some kind of contempt for loner genius, I also, you know, can respect, you know, where it comes from, and say, I don't have to participate in that. And, you know, I'm going to use that as a basis to kind of bounce off of and try to formulate some kind of new concept of what poetry might be. I don't think that poetry should have like a function or purpose, other than straight desire and pleasure. You know, everything's inherently political. So, you know, when we find that politics within it, you know, it doesn't mean that it has to be any less desirable or any less, you know, just kind of like mystical and whimsical.
Yeah.
And kind of on top of that, speaking to how community's kind of working on two different levels, you know, poetry gives us a reason to gather and not, you know, get drunk and not get high and, you know, and I mean, of course, it's okay if people do that. Like, I'm, like, all for, like, you know, people exercising their autonomy.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to, like, celebrate spaces where that's not the main focal point. You know, whenever I first started, I'm in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I first started coming to Pittsburgh, that was the main reason why, was because I wanted to get away from, you know, the places and people and everything that, you know, kind of drove me to, you know, use. And whenever I came to Pittsburgh, I was just like continuously searching for places where that wasn't the focal point. And I wanted to create, and co-create that space for my friends and myself. And that was kind of a personal reason why Ghost Farm kind of existed.
Well, and again, and I think there is something so, we almost, you know, maybe this is the thing, maybe the pandemic will teach us, you know, having community, having contemporaries, having fellow minds is just so inherently human and inherently humane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, going back, what we're saying reminds me of an Atlantic article I read from 1890 about Jane Austen. Which, of course, you know, of course, yeah, everybody gets into the Cornell Making of America archives and reads all the 19th century periodicals that they have there. But there's one about Jane Austen, and the writer makes this really interesting point that outside of her family, you know, and talking about her position as a woman at the dawn of the 19th century, as a woman writer, she would have, her only contemporaries would have been her family.
Hmm.
And those would have been her only readers, and those would have been the only people she had to talk about writing with. And made this point that everybody else, all the male writers, everybody else has contemporaries and can show each other drafts and do this. I was like, oh wow, that's a cool perspective for 1890. To talk about, but I think, yeah, there's something that's so, and not that it necessarily has to be competitive or anything, but almost this kind of, like, community genius that comes out of that sort of a, group. No, go ahead.
I couldn't agree more, and I really have to pay some sort of due to, you know, the writing community, which I was kind of maybe, like, invited into, you know, at my university, at Carlo University, because I started at a community college of Allegheny County studying with Kayla Sargeson, who is a dear mentor and now a dear friend to me, and she brought me to Carlo and told me, you know, take the Madeline in the Attic classes, you know, work with Jan Beatty, you know, and work hard and listen and, you know, you'll be fine. And I never really, and it felt really good to have, you know, the fellow writers there, you know, while I'm not a woman, you know, I'm non-binary, I was still welcomed with open arms, by Jan and the rest of, you know, the Carlo faculty, and just was able to share my work with people of all different types of backgrounds. You know, people in the Madeline, some of them are longtime professors who are now retired and have their MFAs. Some people, you know, met Jan at the airport and and came to a math limit class and started writing poetry. So it's just kind of like this spectrum of people, and that was part of the reason why I felt so welcomed and so inspired and so nurtured, was just through like the utter just unconditional love and support that I feel from my fellow mad women, and I feel from all of the instructors that I've ever had there. And you know, mad women, you have to pay for it, university class. And I guess I really want to just invite it into, you know, our local coffee shop or our local anarchist bookstore, and offer it for free, you know, because it'll just engage a different, community, you know, it'll just engage with different people. And I think both spaces are kind of important and can, you know, lend to one another when they do, especially whenever it comes to ethos, you know.
Yeah. And then the other part of that community is then, you know, the sort of fundraising element of it, or the community partner element, and thinking about, I think in particular, this issue of harm reduction at this moment in history, where, you know, we have this society that puts so much pain into people, and then what do you do with that pain?
Yeah, I mean, at least whenever people think of harm reduction now, people typically only think of it with, you know, people in active addiction.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, harm reduction there is absolutely important.
Yeah.
Though I think that whenever I think about harm reduction, I think about capitalism as kind of the ways in which it is the way that our society works.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I'd say, spectacular. And not the good sense, but in the awe sense, of us watching capitalism spectacularly fail right now.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing that, you know, we all stopped leaving our houses for, you know, 3 weeks, and everyone's kind of begging us to, you know, want to reopen. Like Trump is like, you know, we need to open the country again. And, you know, we're working toward like a soft opening is how I've been kind of jokingly putting it. And, you know, in that capitalism spectacularly failing, you know, in Pittsburgh, there are so many mutual aid networks that are kind of stepping up and really supporting each other. Like, everyone's really supporting each other. And it kind of really solidifies my stance towards, you know, harm reduction and just being, it's like that mutual aid is a way of reducing harm. It's a way of supporting autonomy and solidarity within our community. It's a way to kind of, like, act against, you know, like, you know, the prison system. It's, you know, people are meeting prisoners who are getting out of jail with hand sanitizer and water and coffee and warm clothes. And it's kind of a way to, you know, just, like, give and fight against the, you know, years and years and years. How far back do you want to go with capitalism, I mean? And so it's kind of amazing to me in that way. So.
Yeah, it is. And I think about, and, you know, there were, you know, the protests yesterday and the in downtown Pittsburgh and Harrisburg, and, you know, Ohio was last week. And it amazes me how much conformity to capitalism, obedience to capitalism, obedience to capitalist entities has really formed some people's most deep, most intimate understandings of themselves. That blows my fucking mind.
Yeah, because, you know, people only, or not only, a lot of people consider gain and consumption and getting more of something for as their primary goal, and then whenever the supply chain begins to crumble, not slowly, but just a little bit, you know, there's this, like, that's where, you know, you're seeing all this panic, the panic buying, you know, people just, like, totally freaking out, and then, you know, you go to the other side of the, like, deniers, you know, people are just in denial, they don't want to believe that people are dying, and they don't want to believe that any of this is real, you know, they want to go back to work. They don't understand why, you know, they can't go to work, lead their normal life, earn their money, pay their bills. You know, people are scared. And that's kind of, I don't condone the protests. I definitely believe those people to be very foolish.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's also really hard because I see their fear. You know,
yeah.
Whenever people act that way, I was trained as, because I also studied psychology at Carlo.
Yeah.
I was trained to kind of like look at people and understand and begin to try to understand and empathize and engage in like some kind of like allopathy of like, I will never understand your experience and I'm also uptaking it and observing it and making judgments about it.
Yeah.
Try to understand the amount of violence that they've gone through in their life. Try to empathize with their fear. And, you know, I'm scared too. You know, and I guess this is like a moment where we might say, how do we handle our fear? How do we handle our fear in a way that is, you know, healthy and safe for ourselves and people around us? You know, in protesting in large public places where everyone can see, not sure. Right now, you know, I know a lot of people are doing like a lot of virtual organizing, a lot of like social distancing, vigils, and things like that, you know. I think that those are really productive, mutual aid is really productive right now. I just encourage people to, like, look at their tactics.
Yeah, and I think, too, for me, it's... one really formative thing that happened to me was I accidentally bought a used copy of the Negative Land album Dyspepsy on CD many years ago. And it's sort of fascinating because they posed as journalists from, like, NPR or something, and they wanted to do something on the history of Pepsi. And what audio archives do you have? And Pepsi gave them complete reign of their audio archives.
Wow.
Yes. And then they made this, like, mashup album of all of these samples of...
My goodness!
Yes. And so if you... find a copy of the CD, actually, it's really interesting because it doesn't say Dyspepsy on it. It says all these different anagrams of Dyspepsy, and there was a phone number you could call if you wanted to know what the album was called, because they were so afraid of getting sued. It's brilliant, and the thing that they talked about, you know, there was this soundbite they had, and, you know, their whole point was the Cola Wars, and I think they said something like Pepsi and Coke combined at the time were spending $20 to $30 million every 3 months.
Wow.
To distinguish between two essentially identical products. What could you do with that money in other arenas?
Yeah, I mean, millionaires, of course, I'm under the camp of I don't think millionaires should exist.
Yeah.
And whenever I hear that, you know, these really big businesses who, you know, target us and who, you know, because I mean, I'm pretty sure Mountain Dew is Pepsi.
Yes.
And like, there's like the whole, like, Mountain Dew, like, West Virginia fiasco that, like, happened. I'm not sure what year this happened, though I do know that Pepsi was specifically targeting people in West Virginia for Mountain Dew, and then people in West Virginia didn't have, like, consistent access to dental care, and they basically, like, rot their teeth from consuming too much Mountain Dew. And whenever I think about the amount of targeting and the amount of marketing and that kind of, like, went into... So, like, basically, like, pandering to, like, a specific, like, demographic of individuals. I just think about the violence that that is.
Yes.
Like, that decision by Pepsi impacted the individual experience of so many people in, like, a very, like, underprivileged, like, area. And so, you know, it's just kind of amazing. Not, like, amazing in, like, a good way, but...
But amazing
is...
I'm
awestruck by it.
Yeah.
It's infuriating and just unbelievable to me.
So one of the samples in there then was found, somebody, some instruction on how to do advertising. And they talked about that last foot in the supermarket. that last foot, when the hand reaches, that last foot has to be driven by emotion somehow.
Yeah.
Which, to think about that kind of violence, and to think about how few, for a lot of people, I would say, how few alternatives to that sort of capitalist emotional violence, that emotional targeting. For many, many millions of Americans, there's no alternative to that. There is just, this is how you express yourself, this is how you fulfill your needs, this is maybe also how you fulfill your identity. Your, not just your physical, I need the liquid needs, but also your sense of self and being. And yeah, how incredibly violent that is, and how important is it to create alternative communities to that have maybe just a different message.
That, well, I mean, on top of us having, you know, or Goat Farm having a different message, I think that, you know, we see this kind of violence happen in marketing, in literature, mm-hmm. in media, and everywhere. And actually right now, in light of the pandemic, we're putting together a writing Skillshare series, you know, where we're teaching people how to write resumes and cover letters. We're talking about creative writing ethics, which would include things like marketing and media. And stuff like that. And we're talking about, you know, how to write grants. And, you know, we're currently in the brainstorming stages of other possible ways of writing we could, you know, share for free with the world. And I think that, you know, teaching people literary skills will, because I don't believe that capitalism is going to go away overnight. I mean, it's a pipe dream, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, but being able to inform yourself and use those skills to, you know, make you more informed about the world around you, the ways in which people word things to invoke emotion from you.
Yeah.
And just, like, being able to kind of, you know, use those and inform others and, you know, just be able to kind of, you know, fight back and revolt in your own way. You know, I think that sharing knowledge with one another and learning with and being taught to from others is one of the most invaluable, indispensable things that, you know, we have as people. And I think that, you know, picking a lens and trying to be able to learn together through that lens is just important because you'll discover so much, you know. I think poetry is theory.
Yeah.
So it's like we're kind of able to break apart, you know, the inner workings of our world and through a speaker, which is kind of beautiful to me.
Yeah. Which may be an interesting transition then to talk about another thing you're deeply involved in terms of the power of the word, which is the Filler Distro.
Yes. Yeah, Filler. So the Filler Collective is kind of interesting because it exists and it does not exist, which is intentional. You know, really, we don't want to have an organization. We don't want to be an organization. We don't want to commandeer anyone's personal belief system. You know, I mean, really, I guess what we do is we share a lot of anti-capitalist, anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti, you know, all of the anti's, propaganda on social media. You know, we're a distro. We conduct peer mental health support. You know, we have a label. And basically, we put out zines and, you know, share news and, you know, applaud whenever people get out of prison and try to support, you know, people writing to prison. And, you know, we send out mail orders and try to supply people with, you know, literature and things like that. And really, it's just a name that basically almost anyone can use to promote their projects, you know, as long as it's, like, anti-fascist.
Well, that's great. And I think for me, too, that what appeals, you know, why I wanted to have this conversation and how, you know, seeing Filler Distro around gives me hope is, you know, we're also in the midst of this, right, disaster election we're having again, aren't we? Or at least, it, to me, it feels so profoundly hopeless.
Yeah, I mean, voting for two rapists is not something that I'm going to do, personally.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's a rapist, Trump is a rapist, I have no interest in offering my support for either, personally.
Yeah, and it's like slow death or fast death, I guess, is what we're choosing. Like, that's, you know, I want to suffer. You know, and it's like, well, if that's not the thing, and I've already mourned, I've already, you know, I think deep down we all know Trump is going to get reelected. I just saw, speaking of, like, capitalism and resentment and anger and violence and emotional manipulation, this afternoon I watched the Trump-Nancy Pelosi $24,000 refrigerator ad.
I don't think I've seen that. I'm going to have to put that on my list.
It's quite something. And it's quite, I mean, it's a splice between Nancy Pelosi going through the ice cream selections in her two industrial kitchen fridges and how she has, like, all these flavors of ice cream available to her, interspliced with, you know, again, middle Americans who are like, this is what I got. This is what we have to make last.
Yeah.
And it's enraging and infuriating, and it could be the, the Daisy nuclear war ad.
Yeah, it was like the plume.
Yes, I mean, it's the Lyndon Johnson, Barry Goldwater ad, maybe, of our generation or our election cycle.
Wow.
And it ends in, you know, Nancy Antoinette, Let Them Eat Ice Cream, is the inner title at the end. And it's like, damn, like, oh my god. And I can see how that is so going to reach people at their moment of frustration in a way that the Joe Biden yellow scare ad isn't.
It's just, the news, I've been trying to kind of put it on mute here for just a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm gonna like catch up whenever the quarantine kind of like subsided a bit.
Yeah.
Nothing that's happening appears to be good. It feels like everyone is willing to endanger many people at all times, regardless of your party affiliation. Yeah.
Yeah, which, though, I think for me, then, is for me sort of maybe very desperately looking for hope and aside from, you know, kind of bullshit nostalgia, looking at things like this happening in the city, like Goat Farm and Filler and these attempts and, you know, all of these organizations, you know, that are trying to bring people together in, I don't want to use the word organic because organic is so, like, using the word organic to describe anything creatively, I think, is like the new thinking inside the box, or you gotta think outside the box, kind of cliche, but.
I'll offer you a word.
Okay.
The way in which I kind of have taken it is like a synchronous, like, It feels like my involvement with all of the people in my life who do Filler or who do Goat Farm, it's all just like one big, like, synchronicity. And it's kind of amazing how we all just kind of fell into each other at the time that we did, you know?
Yeah. I always say years ago, when the 10th anniversary edition of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique came out, in the foreword to that edition, she makes this great line about how a woman no longer has a private image by which to judge herself. Hmm. Which to me is like, oh, that's a deliciously, in the middle of the Cold War, anti-capitalist thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And how all of those messages override any, and yeah, I think synchronous is a much better word. Idea of who we are, where we're going, who we can and should be, that instead comes from our community, not from somebody's marketing department.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, recently I've been, like, you know, thinking about, like, the spectacle and, you know, like, what makes a spectacle? Am I a spectacle? And, you know, thinking about and, like, I also think about memes a lot. I don't know if you think about memes a lot.
I do, too. Yes.
I kind of always, memes always feel like, the spectacle, like, kind of, like, it's like you take, like, a pair of pants and, like, stick both of your hands down the legs, and then you just, like, pull them out really fast. That's how, like, memes feel to me, like, with my intersubjectivity.
Yeah.
Because it almost feels like, you know, they can, like, see, like, underneath, like, my, like, outer layer that, like, I show to the world and just, like, totally turn it inside out in a way that, you know, everybody's, like, kind of, like, collective unconscious just... It's like, yeah, that I get that, but I don't understand why, but I get it. It's just kind of confusing and amazing. And, you know, whenever I think about memes as it relates to, you know, how, like, capitalism is, like, informing our identity, I feel like a lot of the time, like, people kind of use memes in the same way where it's, you know, not, like, in the same way, but in, like, the opposite way where they'll, like, make it so nonsensical and so, like, grandiose that, you know, all we can do is, like, laugh at ourselves.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, the way I think about memes is very similar. Memes, I think, are incredible for exposing moral hypocrisy.
Yes.
They are so fucking good at that. Oh, my God. So good.
Yeah, it's like, I love memes for that, you know?
Yeah, and not to harp on this election, but you think we have two candidates whose central appeal to their base doesn't survive a 60-second Google search.
Yeah.
You can just go, actually, that's untrue. You know, actually, they did this other thing that you're saying that they do. You know, the fear, I guess, I have for memes, and I think it does actually get to, like, this is the core bullshit. You don't have to read the 6,000-word think piece article to get this perspective. But on the other hand, and this is the trained, classically trained academic in my head saying, yes, but does it do complexity?
I think memes do complexity when shared and discussed with others.
Mm.
I think that memes are really good. Like, memes are like deep. You know, you read, like, 5 pages in a room full of your friends, and then you discuss. And, you know, you never know what someone's going to say.
Yeah.
Ever. You know, everyone knows something that we don't. Everyone has something to offer, a different perspective. And so, it's like, for example, like, I'm just, like, thinking about this Joe Biden meme that I saw, and it was just, like, Joe 2020 with his face, and it was like, oh, you're a real Joe Biden fan named two of his complete sentences.
That's why I've seen that one.
And it's like, you know, you just, like, you send, and it's like, you know, you share it with the world, and, you know, everyone has something different to say. You know?
Yeah. So is it more like a Rorschach test, maybe? Are memes this kind of very...
Yeah, like some sort of, like, free association is, like, in terms of, like, discursive introspection. Like, if you want to, like, be, like, super technical with it. But essentially, I think so.
Yeah.
From my own perspective, you know, I mean, of course, like, some memes are just, like, you know, like a frog in a doorway, and it just says soup time at the bottom. But, like, you know, but some... Everyone has their own kind of, and once you start to, like, deconstruct the joke, deconstruct the meme, I mean, it's just, I feel like, you know, it's just like, that's like the bread and butter of, like, intersubjectivity. You know, it's kind of amazing to me. Yeah, and I mean, I think I also feel the same way about poems. It's, you know, we, like, speak it, and then we discuss it, and then it's just like, and if something happens different to everyone else, you know?
Yeah, and we should get to some poems. Let's get to some poems. But on the way there, I also think now you're making me think about, in this conversational thread, about how sometimes, I know when I work with students, they don't trust, they've been trained, at least in terms of poetry, they've been trained not to trust their spontaneous reactions.
Yeah.
Like, am I allowed to laugh at this?
Yeah.
Which is so sad, you know? Or, I think this is about sex. And I was like, yes, it is. You know, it's...
Yeah.
I always love, if I'm ever teaching an anthology that has Emily Dickinson's Wild Nights in it,
uh-huh.
I always, like, my teaching of that poem is, it is what you think it's about.
I, like... Sometimes I wish I had, like, the reserve to be like, oh my gosh, did I laugh at this? I've gotten myself in trouble for sure, like, laughing, like, whenever I'm not supposed to, or, like, gasping, or just being, like, in total disgust, and, like, you know, I think that, it's also, like, caused me because, at Goat Farm, I never send out the packet, like, a day before workshop, because I don't want people to, like, have time to spend with it. I want to interact with people the first time that they're reading it.
Wow.
Always. Because of this, you know, I want people to trust their instincts. You know, for some people, they'll read a poem once and never read it again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that first interaction with it is so important because, you know, it lands on an editor's desk. You know, you're sending your work out. The first reaction is priceless.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So I agree. It's sad that people don't trust their first reaction. I mean, your first reaction can totally get you in trouble, but sometimes the writer might want to know that.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's one of the ways that maybe this expectation of perfection that kind of hangs over all of us
kind of robs
us of something.
I've been watching America's Next Top Model during quarantine. And I swear that this is related, but one of Tyra Banks' like catchphrases is "perfect is boring," and I just like that. I love that. Like, I just love that little tagline: "Perfect is boring." Yeah, you gotta like mess up the hair a little bit after you put the gel in.
Yeah, and perfect is so alien.
Yeah, none of us know what it is. Right?
Yeah. But yeah, so can we talk about your poetry and your poetics and maybe could you read a couple things for us, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so for you, I mean, what, you know, if we can loop back in terms of what inspires maybe your poetry or what is your primary sort of aesthetic focus with poetry?
My aesthetic focus with poetry
is
narrative and clarity. I really just like love writing about like sex and, you know, my gender experience. I love writing about, you know, my experience living on the road. And I just love, you know, writing about just like micro interactions that I have with people. Additionally, you know, I studied in my undergrad both psychology and poetry at the same time. If I had to say the kind of like lens, which I come from, it's like interpersonal, and you know, I really love phenomenology, like a whole lot. And so I'm very much concerned with the now, and I kind of have taken like a lot of inspiration from my psych advisor, Patricia Jameson, and she kind of will present the information to us in a way that she wants us to respond through, like, evocation, basically, indwelling. So she'll kind of, you know, give a lecture, and then we'll have to write, like, 3 pages a week on how the information and the theory evoked, you know, within my life. And so, you know, a lot of the times I would get poems from that.
Oh, wow.
I would be, like, studying theory and then writing about how it applies to my life, and then I would be like, wow, I forgot about this micro interaction that I had with my mother as a child. This is a poem, you know? Or like, I'll like kind of like find like different like paradoxes and like ironies that exist in my life and a bunch of other people's lives and try to like synthesize that into like one page of a poem. So that's kind of like the approach that I take.
That's that sounds wonderful. And I always say to my students when reading literature, and of course, for them, and, you know, and for some of my students, like, they'll never read a novel again. After they're done with me. Is like how a work maybe speaks to the fault lines of everyday experience.
Yeah.
And where those unsettled moments are.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I watched and then rewatched the, you did the Instagram live reading last night for White Whale Books. And I was thinking about all of those wonderful poems that you read. And how all of them have this, there is this collision that happens. And this desire to preserve this experience and try to understand it, but understand it in a way that the audience can color in their own experience.
Yeah, this is actually, obviously a lot of my work is very intense and visceral and triggering for some people, I'll admit. And my big, this is actually something that I've been kind of thinking about a lot lately, so I'm really glad that you brought this up. And basically, I don't want to traumatize my audience. That's 100% something I don't want to do. I don't want people to walk away feeling in shock or lost within themselves and their own experience. You know, I want to kind of provide a playing field. I want my poems to be spaces where people can play safely within their own experience, you know, and like play with the darkness, play with their fear, play with their shock, play with their, you know, trauma, you know, kind of like I want people to play with their trauma in the same way that poetry has allowed me to play, you know.
But
I don't want to shock anyone. So, you know, I just want to kind of honor my readers just as much as I honor, you know, myself through my work.
Yeah, and that word play, I think, is so interesting as a way of putting it, because, yeah, with play assumes that there is not a right answer or a predestined conclusion.
Yeah, because, I mean, in my opinion, there's not, I mean, ever, you know, I mean, of course we can make endings. Endings are made all the time, you know, and is it ever really over? is my kind of question, you know. Even after, like, things end for us, they typically kind of go on for everyone else, you know.
And the way that things live in memory, I mean, it just happened to me today. You know, I was reminded of something that happened 30 years ago. I'm walking the dog, and it just popped in there, and it felt, and it was something traumatizing that had happened that I had sort of forgotten about, or even didn't understand the meaning of it at the time. And yeah, well, that's the importance, I think, of creating forms of expression, alternative narratives, so that we have something to do with that or understand. I mean, that's a very Lacanian thing, right? The language to understand our experience. And isn't that what trauma is? That we lack that language and we lack that symbolic order.
Right. I think that personally, I mean, yeah, I too kind of like, I mean, I would be a liar if I didn't say that whenever I first set out writing poetry, it was 100% to try to, like, gain language to kind of communicate and synthesize and understand my experience. You know, and I think that as time's gone on, you know, and I've been, you know, kind of approached and talked to you about, you know, the ways in which my work has impacted other people, you know, I found kind of a new purpose within it, you know. I mean, of course, to continue to gain language and to kind of like sift through, because it's funny. A lot of the poems that, you know, I read yesterday are really, my original draft was maybe 3 years ago. And I kind of like put it in like a cupboard somewhere and like let it, I heard a writer say this once. I think it might have been Otessa Moshfegh, like she came and gave a lecture at Carlo. She says that she takes a draft and then she just puts it away in like a cabinet and like pretends it's like an oven. And then, but she like bake it for years.
Wow.
And it won't come out until it's like ready and like you just know. You know, just like, you know, you put like a pinch of something in, like, you know, just a little like throw in, or, you know, you have to like listen for the popcorn, like for the kernels to stop popping like a minute apart or something. You know, it's kind of the same way whenever you're ready to like look at a poem. You know, because, or Jan Beatty, she says, you know, some poems take 20 minutes, other poems take 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, you never really know like when it's going to happen or like what's happening. Sometimes I don't even know what's happening on the page, and I just, you know, just let it happen.
So can we hear a poem? Can I request that, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a bunch of poems sitting in front of me. I will read. I had the poem. Oh, sitting here. Oh, here it is. I'll read my personal favorite poem.
Okay.
Of my own. That's okay.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. This one's titled, I Cut My Underwear Off. In preparation for sex in the pizza fiesta bathroom, after standing up to take a piss, I was wearing my Doc Martens and didn't have enough time to lace them up again. I took my keys and saw by the seam, as I frayed black thread, I could hear what you said to me. The last time I wore these, the last time you wanted to fuck me, the last time you wanted to fill my void. These are cute. The lights flicker and hum. Flashes highlight the bridge of my nose and darken the bags under my eyes. I drag my finger along my heavy lower lip. I look at your body and hear you say, take it off. Take your clothes off. I can see myself in the mirror. I am trapped in my own reflection. I stay steady in the cycle of sex relentless. My hand grazes the back wall. I can feel its skin, thick with paint, no primer and redone. It's prime time with eyes locked and mesmerized by the blank stare I hold while each fuck comes in and out. In and out, the men come in and out of my body, in and out of this bathroom. Never make me come, never take them home. How many more men do I have to fuck before I feel okay in my own body? How much longer do I allow them to visit me here? How much longer do I allow them to devour my neck and slam me down against the sludge-covered linoleum? How much longer do I have to?
Wow.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's, wow. I'm sorry. It is, I've heard you read that one before. I'm stunned by it every time.
Yeah. This is actually a breakup poem. You know, people don't even know or realize that. And, you know, I remember whenever I first started writing it, it was this really just like boxy, maybe like a 10-line poem, you know, and it's just kind of, now it's like it spans two pages, you know, several stanzas, and it's just kind of amazing, because I remember editing this into its final form. I just went on like this total frenzy that, like, throughout the night, it was like I was working on finishing this for my one creative writing class, you know, because it was finals week and everything, and I just had a moment where I was like, I need to edit this poem. This poem is totally wrong. And then it kind of poured out of me in like the span of a half an hour, and I was like, wow, you know, how the poem surprises us more than I surprise myself sometimes.
Yeah. And Pizza
yeah,
Fiesta.
Yeah. Pizza Fiesta, I know. It's funny. I guess I should say that that did not happen. You know? I'll put that on the record right now. I did not have sex in the Pizza Fiesta bathroom. Put that on the record. Andy, the guy who runs Fiesta.
Yeah, I think there's something so utterly absurd about that name, and
it really, because they're not, like, you know, they're I can't remember where they're from, you know, but they're from somewhere in Asia, and you know, and then to own a restaurant named Pizza Fiesta, you know, it's just the absurdity is just really just through the roof, and it's, you know, one of just one of those things that's kind of interesting. You know, but if you've been in Pizza Fiesta, it's like a totally disorienting experience.
Yes.
there's like this Italian, like, map just hanging from the ceiling, like cardboard Italian map hanging from the ceiling, and there's always like baseball playing and like all of these like pictures of like really stock, like maybe like even like Subway food, and then you just like then there's just the long hallway. The long hallway back to the bathroom. And yeah, I mean, I describe the bathroom in this poem. But yeah, it's a totally disorienting and like strange, you know, but yeah, I remember writing this poem and it was just like really kind of exploring like my sexuality and trying to kind of like synthesize and understand, you know, the sexual being that like is myself, and it's kind of hard, you know, because a lot of, I mean, I've been told, you know, to stop writing about sex. I've been told that, you know, I've heard degrading things kind of like be talked about with me and my work, as a result of sharing things which celebrate, you know, my sexuality, even the dark parts of my sexuality, you know, the parts of myself that kind of frustrate me. You know, I think especially toward the end, I'm just like asking the question, like, how much longer, how much longer, how much longer?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it's kind of important, like, it's important to celebrate and explore, you know, sexuality. You know, my first poetry book that I read, which had a theme of sex, was, you know, Jennifer Jackson Berry's The Feeder. You know, and Jennifer Jackson Berry is fabulous. You know, I've sat through like two guest lectures of her, and I've seen her read, you know, a few times, and each time it's just utterly blown away, you know, and I have a copy of The Feeder, and she signed it, and I remember she said, you know, like, keep writing about sex, and she, like, underlined it, like, over and over and over again. And, like, sometimes whenever I feel so just, I don't know, put down by other people, or, you know, like, people are telling me to, like, stop celebrating this part of myself,
yeah.
You know, I just kind of, like, open The Feeder, like my copy of The Feeder, and I go, yeah, I'm just gonna keep doing my thing.
Absolutely, and I think, again, that's the most, I mean, if poetry and art, and especially non-corporate, or whatever that means, poetry and art, are supposed to be vehicles for us to understand our experience.
Yeah.
And we can't, you know, I guess you can try to live in Disney World, I guess?
Disney World's no paradise either.
Yeah, it's really not, I mean...
You know what I mean? It's like, you look at all the early Disney movies...
Song of the South. Yeah. Well, I guess that's the other thing, too, is I think, you know, I always wonder, or even you look at something like the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
Yeah.
I mean, what a deliciously evil, menacing film. And that's a children's movie. And there's part of me is like, you know, our society is so traumatizing and so violent, and we are so fucked up. Like, we just walk around as blobs of fucked up, even people who don't think they are.
Right.
And yet, this is the culture we have. And it's like, what do you do other ways, maybe? Or do we just have to, like, do we have to explore it? Do we have to deal with it?
Right.
And in like, one way or another.
I always get so frustrated because I think the same people who, you know, tell me to stop writing sex poems are the same people who, well, I can say this because I know who's, you know, told me to stop writing poems, and I guess if they're listening to this podcast, they'll hear this too. you know, but they're the same people who tell me to stop writing about sex are the same people who I've heard, you know, call people sluts or, you know, kind of really shame women and, you know, people who you know, people who have a body like mine, you know, I'm non-binary, people who really shame, you know, that version of sexuality. It's like, you know, it's like, how dare I have contempt for it? For my own sexuality. It's like, I wonder, you know, what narratives have taught me that instead of the same one that the person holds who's telling you to stop writing.
Yeah,
this contempt was taught to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, I want to unpack that, you know? Writing about it is like the only way that I really know how. So it's like this like weird like cycle where I just say, well, I know what you are, but what am I?
Yeah. And I think for that person, you know, it reminds me of my like brief but transformative union organizing experience, where oftentimes that first conversation where you confront somebody with, okay, your life works this way, or this is how your life goes on. What if it was this other thing?
Right? Yeah.
That first spontaneous contact is always fear and revulsion. So often, fear, revulsion, terror, and shame.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was talking to my partner about this, and because we were actually talking about, you know, filler and everything, like the kind of like things that like how filler kind of like works and everything. We were talking about like, you know, like social war and like what that kind of like looks like.
Yeah.
And it's like living as, you know, I mean, of course, I'm white, you know, I don't understand, you know, what it's like to not be white, and I like acknowledge my privilege, and it's like I, you know, the ways in which I relate with others is, you know, a way that like basically everything that I was taught growing up is something that I've tried to do the exact opposite of. And you know, it's like being non-binary, you know, having like a body that people map as woman, you know, like trying to like traverse like academia, you know, and even by doing that, like being the youngest in my family, in, you know, both of my parents being in academia and all of these kinds of things where, you know, I'm existing, I'm being, and people say, no, you're not supposed to be like that.
Yeah.
People say, no, you're not supposed to do that. And I say, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway. You know? Because it's like, I feel like you gotta.
Yeah.
You know? What's the quote? I've been really stuck on quotes. But it's like, success is just a series of failures. That's the quote.
That makes sense.
Like, you know? Right. And it's like, totally cliche maybe, but, you know, it's like, whenever I hear no, over and over and over again, you know, writing about the kind of stuff that I do, is kind of really easy to get really down.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just got to keep trucking. Because there are people who would be like, yeah, write about sex. People are like, yeah, that poem is awesome. Like, whatever. You know, and those people I write for.
So speaking of which, can we have one more poem before the bottom five?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. I'll read a poem that I actually did read last night.
Oh.
This poem is in my upcoming manuscript, which is titled Ritter's Psychiatric Diner and Clinic. And so, yeah, basically it's about, you know, a divorce. And so this is an interesting divorce poem. I threw away my wedding ring. On the 45-minute drive, after my fourth 10-hour shift that week, out the window of my Honda Civic. The tarnished silver band, jade inlay inside a floral design, the one we bought at this and that thrift on the outskirts of Nashville for $11 on the last leg of our joint tour. We came back to Pittsburgh without the know of where we'd be living or if this beat-up clunker would be the next place we called home. I pressed my right middle pointer finger down on the plastic power switch, allowed the glass to roll into the door. I held the steering wheel with my knees as I pulled the metal off my married left hand, furled it around in my palm with my arm dangled from the car. I let it drop onto the painted asphalt as my worn tread tires halted at the yellow turned red stoplight on Route 8 headed toward our apartment in Sharpsburg. How Will I Know played on the Whitney Houston cassette tape, and I turned it up, decided to tell you, I guess it's just fell off.
So good. And we got the driving theme in.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Yeah. I know. I feel like every poem I write, I'm like in the car.
You know, there's just something so wonderfully meditative about it. About driving.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, whether it's driving, you know, just like I lived out of my car for, you know, about like 9 months. And it's just like that experience, just, I loved it so much. I think it's an experience that I would love to go back to again, just like have an RV, just like have that be my house. But also, you know, it's like whether that be like in, I don't know, like late night Walmart parking lots or, you know, it's like going down or just everything. The car is, it's like a second home.
Yeah.
You know, always.
What year was the Civic?
02.
02, okay. Oh, okay, okay. That's exciting. All right. So I had to know.
It was green. It was good. It was a good car. Her name was Miranda. I named it. Miranda.
Miranda.
She treated me well. You know, we drove from Pittsburgh to Salt Lake City on a bad alternator. Which was kind of, I actually have a poem about that. It's called like Honda as Our Broken Home.
Yes, that's right. You read that last night too as well, yes.
Yes, yeah, I did. And basically like whenever we were driving, you know, and this is the same car, you know, we would basically have to choose, you know, we did not get to have the radio and the headlights, and who I was, you know, traveling with was rather volatile. So, you know, I chose to drive in the dark, you know, down, like, in Kansas, you know, if there's no one there, there's nowhere to stop, you know, you really don't have a choice, you know, you just rely on other people to have headlights and hope no large animals, you know, run in front of you, but...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's just so kind of, yeah.
Yes. And so on that note, I think it's now time for the bottom five. The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, question one is a question everybody gets the first time they come on the podcast.
Okay.
And if I forget, the second time they're on the podcast. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
I think I would, like, want to be maybe, like, a disease or illness with, like, everyone, instead of getting really tired, they, like, were filled with a lot of energy. Yeah, like, that's it. Like, if nothing else happens, like, I don't want anyone to die. You know, you just got, like, a bug, a case of the buzz or something. I don't know.
That makes sense. That sounds good. Question two. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write?
So they have to be alive.
They have to be alive. They have to be with us.
You know, I'll go for the big one. I'll take Trump down. I'll write his obituary.
Okay. Solid choice. It's been a solid choice for a while now. It's a solid choice.
I know. It's just like, well, if I had to pick maybe, like, someone else, I don't know. Probably, like, I just hate him so much. No, I'm going to just stick with him.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. It's a good one. It's, you know, and you can take that tack of, like, how did he lose his humanity or whatever.
Right.
But it would be a good read. Question three. This is another concept one, geez. All right, so if we were living in a dystopian future, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. So that's the setup.
Okay.
The dystopian future, different than the dystopia we're living in now, the only books to survive would be bound in human flesh. Would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? And the caveat is, the Bible, the Quran, and the complete works of Shakespeare have already been taken.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody's on those.
Honestly, it's, like, hard because the books I really want to choose are, like, the Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's, like, the Laura Ingalls Wilder series. Like, The Little House on the Prairie and Company. Like, those were probably some of the most informative books of my youth. And, like, I actually love them so much. So I think that it would probably be, like, the whole, like, Little House series.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds surprised. That's a good answer, man. Wow. All right. Question four. We're almost through this.
Let's do it.
What's your earliest memory?
My earliest memory is kind of scary.
Oh.
But I'll share it. I don't mind.
Okay.
My earliest memory was of, like, my parents fighting, and my mom and I were hiding underneath the master bed, and she was basically, like, asking me if she should leave or not.
Oh, wow.
That's my earliest memory. But yeah. There it is.
Makes sense. Wow. All right, and question five. We're almost done. What's the greatest collective mistake in recent memory?
Collective mistake? Like, you mean a mistake everyone has made, or a mistake within a collective that I'm a part of?
Everyone has made. Like, us as a species. Like, way that we fucked up in a really big way.
Oh, glorifying Tiger King?
Love it. Love it. Yes, thank you for saying it. Thank you for having the courage to say that and all the other things that you say.
Of course. I mean, like, I get it. Like, it's like a train wreck that I don't want to look away from, but I'm not going to sit here to glorify it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all.
It's so unlikable. It's shitty rich people. Great. Shitty rich people exploiting other less rich people. And animals.
It's like Carol Baskin is like neoliberalism, and then like Joe Exotic is like straight libertarian, and then like Doc is like this straight, like staunch conservative, and I'm like, why is this like our current political climate like synthesized into like literally this like seven series like Netflix documentary? Like, I just don't understand.
God.
Yeah. So.
That's so true, and that's so bleak.
Isn't it? Like, oh my god. Yeah. So, there it is.
So, is there an ETA on Ritter's psychiatric diner and clinic?
So, I am going to be sending out this month.
All right.
I know. So, hopefully soon. Fingers crossed.
And, of course, we can find out about Goat Farm.
On the Facebook page, and then right now we're currently in the process of creating a no-blog, which is just a website. And we're going to have all sorts of different things, like PDFs of the text that we use during literature discussions, PDFs of zines that we've put out, which include anthologies. We're working on an interview with Yona Harvey, which will be available for order because she didn't want it to be online. And then we're also, going to be having like all sorts of like photos, and we're going to have publications for people to just like send in, like a journal and stuff like that. That should be ready hopefully by the end of May.
All right. So I will post this when I first post this on the website. I will have a link to the Facebook page. And when the website goes live, if I have my shit together, I'll fix it.
Sounds good.
Yes. And filler?
Yeah. So filler, you go to filler.wordpress.com. And we do mostly like distribution of zines. So if there's a zine that you want to get sent out, you just send it to fillercollective.@riseup.net. or not Rhizobe, excuse me, Proton Mail.
Okay. Excellent. And I'll have also a link to your recent poems in Blue Nib, and yeah, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. This was a great conversation, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I had a lot of fun.
Yes. So that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something, I guess. Our homepage where you can find new and old episodes is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and when I remember to upload it, Mixcloud. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you again, Halsey Heyer?
Heyer.
Heyer! I screwed it up at the end. I remembered an hour ago, but now I forgot. Halsey Heyer.
Oh, it's okay.
Yes. And thank you to Andrew Fox for the lovely theme music. Later, mates.